We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm happy to be joined once again by the great Nate Hochman. He's an ISI fellow at National Review. He's a NOVAC fellow at TFAS, and he's also now published in the New York Times. Nate, welcome.
Hey, Emily. It's great to be back.
Sure. I wanted to talk about your New York Times piece, of course. That is the topic of this podcast. Nate had what I thought was a really interesting and well-done piece in the New York Times. What was it, last week, Nate?
Yeah, last Sunday, I believe.
Last Sunday. Okay, great. It was titled, What Comes After the Religious Right? It was very well written. It's 4,500 words. I guessed it was 3,000 words. Nate just disabused me of that notion. It's actually a 4,500 word guest essay in the New York Times, which is a very big deal for a young writer, but also it's just a really smart essay. And Nate, you mentioned the Times approached you about writing this, but how do you see the thesis of this monster 4,500 word piece that you mentioned was 8,000 words about in your first draft? What were you trying to, I guess, distill in this article?
Yeah, the editors weren't going to inflict all 8,000 words of the first draft on the readers, which I can appreciate. But the basic premise of the piece is that, you know, it's not a secret to anyone who pays attention to these things that America is rapidly secularizing. In fact, we're actually secularizing by a lot of metrics at a rate much more quick than other sort of comparable Western countries, because for most of the 20th century, America was kind of the last holdout in the West when it came to church attendance rates. All of Western Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand sort of saw declines in church going attendance throughout the 20th century. Whereas America sort of held steady right around the 80s or the 90s is when we started secularizing. But since then, just we're seeing sort of astronomical declines in expressions of religiosity and association with religious institutions by Americans throughout the country. So that, again, is not a secret. But one of the aspects of this that I think hasn't been paid enough attention to, and this is something that was basically the premise of the piece, was that that's not just happening on the left. Certainly, the decline in religiosity began in the kind of liberal mainline Protestant denominations, but you're now seeing it across the board, including these sort of stalwart religious right evangelical conservative denominations, which have just shed members very rapidly over the course of the last decade. And the point of the piece was to kind of wrestle with what that means for American conservatism, what it means for the Republican Party, and what it means for, you know, inevitably the country writ large, because my point, and I was particularly focused on cultural issues, is that conservatism isn't going away. There's always going to be some kind of right-wing politics in America of some form. But traditionally, at least in the modern era, social conservatism, cultural conservatism has been informed by an explicitly religious and specifically Christian view of politics and the set of issues that the religious right cared about. And now you're seeing a shift because there's very much still a cultural conservatism. And in some ways, you're actually seeing a much more aggressive resurgent strain of cultural conservatism than the one that we saw during, say, the Bush era. But it's much more secular. And the issues are different because the voters are not necessarily the old religious right voters who care about issues like sexuality and marriage. They're much more engaged on issues of national identity, immigration, education, you know, debates surrounding critical race theory in schools. Those are the issues of the kind of emerging secular social conservatism that we're seeing today. So whether or not that's a good thing is obviously an open question. I was more trying to be analytical rather than actually giving my take on what that means in terms of whether or not it's good. But it is happening, and I think it's something that conservatives of every different ideological stripe are going to have to wrestle with.
You're very right to separate that into two different questions. One, is it happening? And then two, if it is happening, is that a good or a bad thing? Because that is, those are two very separate questions, and you don't necessarily have to endorse it to describe it as you do in this piece. And obviously, the barstool conservative, that was coined by Matthew Walther, I believe, in The Week. The barstool conservative formulation is like Dave Portnoy voting for Donald Trump because he couldn't stand Hillary Clinton, couldn't stand the crazy ideas that had come out of Clinton and the Democratic Party and even Joe Biden's Democratic Party, but who said when the draft of the Dobbs opinion leaked that he would vote Democrat again, or if that were the issue in an election. That's the way he phrased it, which is a very interesting insight into people like Dave Portnoy, who were amused by Donald Trump and so unamused by the left that they actually started voting Republican. How much of what you're describing here, Nate, is related to the question of barstool conservatism, which is, I think, a pretty specific question? You know, it's males mostly, I would imagine. If we drilled down into it with social science, we would find it's sort of mostly men. But in general, how specific is the Barstool Conservative Coalition to the broader dynamic that you're describing?
Yeah, I think it's good to point out, actually, I didn't talk about the gendered aspect of this specifically, but a lot of the kind of secular anti-woke voters, the Barstool Conservatives, which is the word that's often used, who are flooding into the GOP coalition are men for one reason or another. And they kind of look and think like, you know, Dave Portnoy, for example, who, again, like we were talking about, I mentioned his Roe v. Wade comments in the piece, is not a religious pro-life voter by any of the stretch of the imagination, but he was sort of repelled by wokeness, cancel culture, you know, the cultural agenda of the left in recent years. And that drove him to vote for someone like Donald Trump. So I think they are a huge constituency, actually. This is kind of my mixed take on what's happening to the GOP. Because on the one hand, in many ways, I am a traditional social conservative. And I think, particularly on an issue like abortion, there have to be lines in the sand. The GOP, for me, it would be unacceptable for the GOP to become a pro-choice party just to try to embrace these voters. We have to hold to certain principles on certain issues like abortion that you just cannot compromise on. But on the other hand, even though declining religiosity, I think, is a profound issue for the country, one of the points I was trying to make in the piece is that this expansion of the GOP coalition actually is a historic political opportunity, because a lot of these Barstool conservatives, and I think these are millions and millions of voters that we're talking about here, these were Bill Clinton voters back in the day. And in many ways, they were repelled by the old religious right for very similar reasons as to why they're repelled by the new kind of puritanical left.
Well, you talk about Pat Robertson yes. endorsing Jimmy Carter, for instance,
right.
which is a,
right.
you even talk about Nelson Rockefeller's sort of this was from Guttmacher, I think you quote, actually Alan Guttmacher, Rockefeller signed the most liberal abortion law in the world.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And that was sort of the history that I was giving, where I was pointing out that was pre-religious right, right? Like I was talking about the rise and fall of the religious right. So it used to be pre-Roe v. Wade that which party was going to be the pro-life party was kind of up for grabs, right? Like most Catholics were Democrats back then, and Catholics were very pro-life. You know, the vice presidential nominee in the 1970s was an ardent pro-lifer for the Democrats. And you had people like Nelson Rockefeller, who was, you know, one of the most pro-abortion rights politician in America. So that was kind of how things looked before the religious right came to prominence. But once the religious right did sort of take over the GOP and identify the GOP as its party and as its platform, all of these kind of moderate to culturally conservative, broadly patriotic, kind of anti-woke, we didn't have wokeness back then, but whatever the precursor was, anti-political correctness voters, a lot of them were voting for sort of moderate Democrats like Bill Clinton, because whatever the critiques of Bill Clinton, he didn't have the kind of woke affect that is so alienating to so many voters today. And they saw the religious right as the side that wanted to come into your bedroom and tell you what to do and ban porn and, you know, try to sort of impose their religious views on the country, right? I mean, I don't agree with that assessment, but that was the view that a lot of Americans took. A lot of those same Americans today see the left as the kind of authoritarian side on the cultural issues. They want to come into your schools, tell your kids things that you don't want, you know, teach your kids about the fact that gender is a constellation, cancel you and get you fired for your job for saying something that isn't politically incorrect. All these things that we're very, very vividly familiar with. The same reason that these voters were repelled by the religious right, they're now repelled by the puritanical left. So that, for the GOP, if we can capitalize on it, I actually think is a huge political opportunity to put together this kind of center-right cultural coalition organized around these issues. But as you were pointing out with Portnoy being pro-abortion earlier, we're going to have to figure out how to appeal to those voters in a way where we don't compromise on core principles. And that's a huge challenge going forward.
Yeah, one thing that's also a big challenge is the kind of constellation of cultural issues. It's really hard to disentangle from the broader constellation of issues in politics because, for instance, my friend Sagar and Jetty points out all the time that opposition to socialism doesn't spring from this well, and this is part of what national Republicans got wrong in the Tea Party wave. It doesn't necessarily spring from this well of, you know, intellectual opposition to, you know, bigger bureaucracy so much as it's sort of rooted in this like American libertarianism or this cultural idea about what socialism is. So when people talk about socialism, for instance, it's also kind of a cultural issue, and that's what makes it really difficult to kind of piece out what the voter looks like who's maybe motivated to pull the lever, so to speak, for Trump on culture war issues versus economic issues. It's just really, it's so hard to disentangle those variables. And I wanted to ask you about, you write, I think very smartly, you invoke Tim Carney's work in Alienated America, which Tim found that communities where there had a stronger social fabric, so basically civil society was most intact or was most robust, in the primary, not in the general election in 2016, but in the primary, they voted for Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio. But in places where civil society was weaker, they tended to vote for Donald Trump. And you also mention Emily Eakins, who has written for The Federalist many times and is great. You write, in this sense, the fierceness of today's culture wars is actually tied to the decline in organized religion. Frequent church attendance is correlated with more negative attitudes towards gay men, lesbians, and feminists. But as the pollster Emily Eakins noted in 2018, it softened respondents' views of culture war issues such as race, immigration, and identity. So basically what that looks like is nobody is fitting into a particularly neat box at all.
Right. And I think this is actually your point about the sort of elite Republican misinterpretation of the Tea Party movement. It's really instructive because because the language of the Tea Party movement sounded very libertarian, a lot of elite Republicans and conservative intellectuals interpret it as such. But the reason that a lot of Tea Party voters were also part of the Trump base, who was not kind of the Rand Paul style libertarian that people thought the Tea Party was organized around, was because really what the Tea Party was about was this kind of sense that the country was slipping away from voters in the middle of the country, and a desire to defend America against people like Obama, who explicitly said that he wanted to transform the country. And I think that's very much actually why what I'm talking about right now, this phenomenon, is very clarifying, because a lot of the cultural issues that drive Republican voters and Republican-leaning voters, and a lot of the voters who are sort of moving into the Republican Party that we're talking about, is this sort of instinctive patriotism, the sense that America is a good country, this basic sense, sort of good old school, commonsensical American notion that like men can't become women and women shouldn't be competing, or men shouldn't be competing in women's sports, that we should have a border, right? Like all these sort of basic issues that kind of are the core of our culture war debates today. That's really what the culture war is about to the average American voter who is engaged on these issues, particularly on the right. And that was kind of the point about citing all those statistics that you mentioned, is that the religious right, the issues that they cared about, a lot of Americans cared about, don't get me wrong, but they were often kind of narrow, right? Talking specifically about the definition of marriage, for example, or about, you know, the role of homosexuality in mainstream life, those were important issues during the time that they were being debated, but they didn't get to this sort of broader comprehensive cultural debate over, say, the meaning of America, and what American identity meant. That really is the organizing principle today, because it is not this sort of explicitly religious or Christian sheen on the right. The right is really engaging directly with those issues, which has made the culture war much, much more intense. That was one of the points that I was making. The decline of religion, paradoxically, has actually supercharged the culture wars. But it's also why, and this is the kind of optimistic aspect of what I'm talking about, as much as the decline in religion is a serious issue, it's why I think the right is better situated to actually fight and win the culture war today than they have been, at the very least, in my lifetime, because they actually kind of understand the core issues that turn voters out and motivate them, and are engaging on those directly rather than misunderstanding what their voters are actually trying to tell them.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free pricing on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. Right. And the flip side of that coin is that Democrats are hostile, not just hostile to what voters want, but hostile to even understanding what voters want. And they're trying to. In some cases, you see groups like Third Way or James Carville try to engage and try to push the party to engage with it. But the resistance to those ideas, it's one of the most interesting things to follow on the left right now. It's this tug of war between the James Carville, Third Way groups of the world and the progressives. And I thought this played out really interesting in the case, I forget her name, the Michigan lawmaker. Do you remember him talking about, Nate, who went viral because she pushed back on someone who had called her a groomer? I think one of her opponents had called her.
Oh, yes. Yeah. She's a state lawmaker, I think.
Yes. Right? Yep. Yeah. Yep. She's like a state representative, assemblywoman or senator, something to that effect. And her entire viral speech that was lauded by James Carville, in fact, was actually pretty much an embrace of the LGBT agenda. And Democrats wrote pieces and did monologues on how this was the key to winning back the heartland and not sacrificing any part of the progressive agenda. But Nate, it seems to me that they're going to have to make some sacrifices if they actually want to engage with those voters again at all, and especially the types of voters who, let's say, just elected Myra Flores in Texas.
Right, exactly. And I think this was another point that I was making in the piece, is one of the reasons that the GOP is so well situated to actually fight aggressively and win on these cultural issues is because the entire institutional left, including the entire institutional Democratic Party, has been captured by this cultural fringe, which will not allow them to compromise on these issues. And in many ways, as you were pointing out, doesn't actually even have the ability, it seems, to comprehend the fact that they're out of touch with average Americans. There is this sense in the Democratic Party that the way to push back against the right is to just get more aggressive on the culture war. And you know, you have to debunk misinformation and call out Republicans vigorously. And there's no kind of sister soldier moment like what you saw from Bill Clinton, where he actually vocally tried to distance himself from the left of his party on cultural issues. The Democratic Party, the moderates in the Democratic caucus, I was citing this in the piece, are perfectly happy to break with the progressives in the party when it comes to economic issues about spending and regulation. But the entire party is basically on lockstep when it comes to cultural issues. You know, the only Democrat to vote against funding for critical race theory in schools in either the Senate or the House was Joe Manchin. And even Joe Manchin hasn't even talked about critical race theory. He hasn't mentioned the word. So the ostensibly conservative Democrats, the Blue Dog Democrats, they're very wary of the kind of more big government schemes surrounding progressivism. But they are completely unwilling to call out the left flank of their party on cultural issues. And the left flank of the party is way, way out of step with the average American on cultural issues. So the right, in many ways, I think, has sort of assumed the position of holding the center on the culture. And that's where I think the kind of appeal to secular voters comes in, because even though the religious right is very much still a force in American life and its priorities are a big part of the GOP agenda on social issues, the broader kind of appeal to this base of, I think, a silent majority of Americans just comes from standing up for basic normalcy. The left now is seen as the party which is against the normal American way of life when it comes to cultural issues. And the GOP is increasingly seen as a side that's standing up for that. And I don't see, just because of the institutional incentives in the Democratic Party, I don't see the party being capable of pivoting to the center on these issues anytime soon.
I think that's right. And one thing that's difficult as I'm trying to sort of game this out in my mind is the rubber meets the road at some point, because you talk about how this played out in the past with the Republican Party, but the majority of the country is not completely pro-life. The majority of the country is pro-gay. The majority of the country is not going to be with the religious right on every single issue. Those are the two big ones that come to mind. And you've been thinking about this, obviously, because you poured thousands of words into a New York Times piece on it, so you may have other ones that are salient. But the question then is, what happens after Republicans consolidate and win on these issues, because they are front of mind for so many people in a way the left doesn't understand, and in a way the right doesn't understand for years. The right is the only political party that has an incentive structure right now that allows them to talk about this stuff in the right way and to do this stuff in the right way. But what happens after? You know, where does this go eventually, if you have Dave Portnoy, a voting Democrat, and others like him? I don't know how common that sentiment would be. It's kind of a hard thing to poll for, who go back to the religious right is all a bunch of crazies because they're super pro-life and praying outside the Supreme Court. Or another good example that I've talked about on the podcast a couple of times is the kisses in Disney movies. Like, there was a meme that went really viral that showed all of the straight kisses in every Disney movie, basically, and said, basically, why is a gay kiss in the Buzz Lightyear movie wrong? Well, that's going to pit the religious right against a lot of the country if they have to explain why they see that as a sexualization that's negative. And so it just seems to me that Democrats aren't, they have lost in the sense that they don't have incentives that allow them to stand up for normalcy right now. But from a long-term perspective, Nate, where do you see this going?
Right. So I think, I mean, what you're getting to is one of the challenges that I think is the great question that Republicans and conservatives are going to have to wrestle with, you know, at least for the rest of my lifetime, which is, as I was saying earlier, trying to balance a commitment to the sort of traditional social conservative priorities with an ability to remain politically viable. So the religious right, if it wants to maintain some amount of political power, they're going to have to find places where they are willing to compromise with the so-called barstool conservatives. Maybe something like that is marriage, right? I mean, 55% of Republican voters now are pro same-sex marriage. So whatever your opinion of gay marriage is, you know, it's just clear that at least in the current sort of cultural context, a Republican candidate running on repealing Obergefell or something, probably not going to be a winning political message, at least outside of the Bible Belt. But at the same time, and this was sort of the point I was making, the new majority that I think we're seeing take shape right now on the right is capable of delivering on old religious right priorities in a way that the religious right never was really able to do. So the perfect example is, if Roe v. Wade is overturned in the coming weeks, it will be have been because of the election of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was only really elected because of these new secular voters. Absolutely, he courted the religious right, and he wouldn't have been elected if the religious right, particularly in places like the Bible Belt, didn't fall in line behind him in the general election in 2016. But you were talking about these Tim Carney statistics earlier. One of the things Carney showed is that the only reason that Trump took the Republican nomination in the first place was because of all these Republican or Republican-leaning voters who didn't go to church anymore. So Trump had this ability to deliver on religious right priorities while also reaching out to and appealing to all these kind of secular Dave Portnoy anti-woke voters. And because of that, he was able to deliver on probably the single defining objective that the religious right has had in politics since the 1970s, which is putting together an ostensibly pro-life majority on the Supreme Court, right? So like there's pros and cons to all of this, because the religious right is going to probably have to make concessions here and there, right? They, you know, freaking out about a gay kiss in a Disney movie, even if from the traditional social conservative, that's distasteful. If you do that too much, you might alienate the Dave Portnoy's. I don't know. But if you are capable of making some kind of common cause with these secular voters, you're going to get pro-life laws. You're going to overturn Roe v. Wade, right? You're going to defend religious liberty in a way that the shrinking religious right as an electoral coalition wasn't able to do on its own. So again, I have kind of pessimistic takes and optimistic takes on this, but I think there's a reason for optimism, because there is, as I said, this growing political majority, which is organized around cultural conservative issues. And that could be a historic opportunity for religious conservatives.
Well, and let's not forget, you know, the success of Dave Chappelle's extremely heterodox right. comedy on Netflix. I think you can read a little bit, at least, into Top Gun doing so well. Ultra patriotic movie doing so well. You can, I mean, there are a lot of cultural signs. Netflix actually just basically chastising its whiny employees who have broached every conceivable strain of progressive criticism of the company. So I think there are signs that, you know, the broader culture is reacting and is now emboldened to the point where they're comfortable pushing back. Where I think this gets even more interesting is that the Republican Party, in a sort of normative sense, ideally has a responsibility to principle. And if the principle is that we have gone so far afield from traditional values or just from common sense in all of these different ways, where like this went so fast from zero to drag queen story hour on the taxpayer dime in front of children, it happened really quickly. The question then seems to me for Republicans, and I'm curious for your take on this, what is, there has to be some understanding of what is right and what is wrong. And a lot of this is just what is wrong. For instance, it is wrong to make taxpayers foot the bill for drag queen story hour at the local library for a group of six-year-olds. But then is what is right just neutrality? What is neutrality in 2022? And so does the Republican Party, in the sense that there's this question about like, have our shifting marriage norms, have our shifting norms on life, have all of these things done some sense of like psychological collective, or not psychological, but collective problems for the entire country? And then does that mean that some traditional values need to be restored? And if that's the case, I guess to me that poses a really interesting question for Republicans as they start talking about these issues, talking about Disney. You can only push back for so long, because broadly the culture is, it's mostly with the sane people. It's mostly with the dissident liberals, the Abigail Schreiers, the everyone. It's mostly with them, Brett right. Weinstein, Joe Rogan, but those people aren't fundamentally conservative. So how do you talk about the issue if you don't have a positive thing to put forward, unless your answer, Nate, would be that the positive thing to put forward is neutrality?
Well, you're absolutely right, Emily, that I think this is one of the huge gripes that a lot of, you know, people like me, sort of social conservatives, have with the GOP, is that it is often scared of speaking about issues and approaching issues from a positive moral vision. It only really wants to talk about things in terms of neutrality. And that's not only sort of morally flat and relativist, it also just isn't appealing to voters. Voters like someone who's offering a positive vision for what their America should look like. But I would say, I think, you know, the kind of issues that we're talking about and the kind of vision that we're talking about appealing to is and can be a positive moral vision, right? Like pushing back against critical race theory in schools, for example, is because critical race theory is wrong. It's immoral. It teaches students not only to view each other as sort of the conglomeration of systems of oppression and you know, racial identity, but it also teaches students evil things about their country. It teaches them to hate the country that they're going to inherit. The same thing is true, obviously, with the transgender issue. Breaking down the distinctions between what men and women are is immoral. I mean, that's a profoundly moral issue, which speaks to these moral sensibilities that the majority of Americans still have. So I think all of these sort of new culture war issues that we're talking about, which appeal to secular voters, do speak to a kind of commonsensical morality, which is really important to be preserving and talking about. And that's the appeal of this kind of project. I think the perfect example of someone who is kind of tapping into these new issues, and I mentioned him in the piece, but is offering a positive moral vision, is Ron DeSantis, right? I mean, there's a reason that the Florida model emerged right around the time of COVID as kind of an alternative to where so much of the rest of the country was going. When, you know, all of Blue America was locking down and was telling kids they had to stay home. And, you know, later on, when the sort of critical race theory and gender ideology debate started, was teaching kids these poisonous doctrines in schools. DeSantis was holding up Florida as an alternative way forward. He was saying, you don't have to go that way. We can go this way instead, where in Florida, you can be free. Your business can remain open. Your kids aren't going to be indoctrinated. They're going to be taught this is a good country. We're not just going to ban critical race theory. We're actually going to start this entire new program of civics education, where we actually start teaching kids about how American government works again. You know, this Miami is a, you know, one of the fastest growing cities in America. All of these things, they're not just neutrality. They're actually a positive, coherent, and easily understandable vision of an alternative for where America could go instead of where the left wants to take it. So what someone like DeSantis is doing by tapping into these issues is saying it doesn't have to be this way. Most Americans are alienated by the cultural left. That's pretty obvious now. The GOP has to have the moral courage and clarity to actually give people an alternative vision. So you're absolutely right. The neutrality is not going to cut it, both at a political and a moral level. But I think the issues we're talking about don't have to just be flat and morally relativist. They can actually offer this positive vision of a different way forward, which is very profoundly moral in a lot of different ways. It's just not as explicitly religious as the old kind of religious conservatism was.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And there are issues that are going to come up. As you were talking, I was actually thinking of surrogacy and IVF, because I think these are actually going to become even like hotter button political issues than they are. It seems as though the cultural consensus, especially if you look at the way that they're treated in popular culture, is that this is good. But I think as the envelope keeps getting pushed further and further, for instance, Andy Cohen from Bravo, who I really like, said just this week that he had two children via surrogacy. He said, you know, if his children aren't able to have children, then maybe in 20 years they can, quote, defrost their siblings and raise them. And that is sort of beyond Brave New World. It's this technological and cold way of talking about something that's just like a punch in the gut when you think about what it actually is talking about. And so I guess if Ron DeSantis would, and I'm not saying this is like a serious proposal that he should do right now because this isn't my area of expertise, but if Ron DeSantis were to take that issue on, you know, I think that would be a really important matter of principle if it was done correctly. But I think it would be extremely toxic politically. I don't know. An example like that, what do you think, Nate?
Well, I think actually the surrogacy example is really instructive because what you're talking about, this kind of dystopian technological, you know, barren landscape where people aren't really humans anymore, that is increasingly where the left is moving towards, ties into all of these other issues, abortion, the deconstruction of gender, right, the denial of biological differences between men and women. All of these things, it's pretty clear where the left is going is this kind of transhumanist utopian vision, where the basic concept that, you know, we have traditionally had in this country, and I think has been sort of one of the building blocks of Western civilization, of the human person as a unique person made in the image of God with inherent dignity. The left is completely moved on from that view. So they've moved to a place where even your basic biology doesn't dictate anything about you. You can transcend that. You can transcend, you know, with surrogacy, childbearing. You can transcend the idea that you know, unborn children have basic rights when they're within the womb. All of those things has this kind of techno-dystopian aspect to it when you hear the left talk about it. They don't think of human beings as humans in a lot of ways in the traditional sense. But again, the kind of Florida model, just because I think it's particularly instructive, what it's offering fundamentally is a more human way of life. The kind of COVID lockdown hysteria came from this very cold, bureaucratic public health view where people were just units and they thought of people in terms of sort of viral spreaders. And they didn't really view the fact that kids needed to be educated, humans needed to interact with each other, people needed to have a social life, all of those things that just didn't register for the kind of public health bureaucrats who were dictating policy at the federal level. DeSantis was offering a human alternative where you could still be a human being in Florida. You could still be a free person, not just on the cultural issues, but on the COVID stuff. All of that, I think, really gets to the actual fundamental conflict of visions that is the root of the culture war debates today. So I think the surrogacy example that you brought up is actually perfect because it ties into all of these other issues, which is what we're fundamentally debating is, again, like the meaning of what it means to be human and what that actually looks like in terms of our way of life going forward.
Yeah, this is something you can probably tell that I struggle with just even on a personal level when I think about comedians, for instance, that I really love. Somebody like Joan Rivers, who pushed the envelope on obscenity laws, or not obscenity laws, but on, well, I guess kind of. She was the first woman to talk about being pregnant on late night, which I guess was considered beyond the pale at the time. But somebody who like really pushed the envelope of what's considered normal in our pop cultural space. But you can actually only do that if you're not seeking to normalize it, right? Like if you have boundaries to challenge, that's when the jokes are funny. If those boundaries go away, the jokes aren't really funny anymore and you have a very coarse culture. So can you have one without the other? I don't know. Camille Paglia writes about how older movies where they actually had to adhere to very stringent obscenity laws are much, much sexier because there's less nudity and having to sort of abide by those rules forced people to make much more interesting and kind of mysterious work. I think that's all very true, but I guess the point I'm getting at is some of these things are, our society has changed so quickly and so dramatically that some of these things that the religious right would agree increasingly are just beyond the pale, are have been like really detrimental to the health of our culture. They're beyond even question at this point. I think with a majority of Americans, we all laugh at Tipper Gore, but you know, maybe Tipper Gore had a point.
Right. Yeah, no, I think the comedian point is actually perfect as well, because it's not a coincidence that all of the funniest, most transgressive comedians today are making jokes about left-wing cultural views, right? I mean, Ricky Gervais, Dave Chappelle, you can go down the list of the kind of most prominent comedians. They're all targeting issues like the transgender issue now. And they're getting the same sort of hysterical, puritanical response from the left that I think some of these sort of earlier lefty types were getting from the religious right when they were challenging sort of obscenity laws. Because the new kind of puritanical public religious norms now are very left-wing. They used to be religious and sort of small c conservative, and the rebellious eccentrics and individualists and comedians and dissidents were all challenging a kind of small c conservative orthodoxy. Now that things have shifted so radically to the left, you know, all of these kinds of people who might have been leftists 4 or 5 decades ago are, if not conservative, they're kind of aligned with the right on these cultural issues. And those are the kinds of people I'm talking about. So to be clear, it's not a good thing that this is the state of play, right? The fact that our norms in American public life have shifted so far to the left is a serious problem from the conservative perspective. But it also has opened up, like we're talking about, this enormous political opportunity where all of these people who felt like the old conservative norms were stifling are now rebelling against the new left-wing norms, which are equally, if not more, puritanical than anything the religious right was ever championing. And that's why you see all the comedians that we're talking about, all the kind of rebellious, you know, eccentrics, they are challenging left-wing orthodoxy today, and they're hated by the left, and they're kind of allied with the right. And I think that represents millions of Americans. You know, Dave Portnoy is another good example. All of these people are, they just want to basically be left alone. And they see the left as the authoritarian side, which is trying to come into their life and tell them and their families what to do. And the right has an enormous opportunity to position itself as the side that's going to stand up for them.
Yeah, except then they'll have to do it without, and you know this, and you write about this, without also looking like the authoritarian side that wants right. to come into their house and tell them. But the point is that the culture should exist in a way that people want to do those things, and they don't need government compulsion to, for instance, you know, have two-parent homes and all of that good stuff. And I actually think an important point in everything that you were just talking about is part of this journey right now, America's journey to sort of push back the radical left that's been mainstreamed by all of our cultural institutions, but hasn't necessarily mainstreamed its own public opinion, is that over that journey, perhaps people discover that we've gone way too far on abortion, that we've gone way too far on IVF, that we've gone way too far on certain technologies or marriage or whatever it is. And at the point when, you know, you can sort of restore some sense of normalcy to American politics and culture, maybe people will be back on the side just of cultural health in general, and norms will have shifted. I don't know, but I guess maybe that's an optimistic way to look at the progression here.
Right. And I think if we ever do get to a point where a lot of these barstool conservatives end up being more aligned with Democrats again, I would actually say that probably means the culture is healthier again, because one of the reasons that they're all shifting into the Republican Party right now is because the kind of cultural orthodoxy has gotten so insane that they see the GOP as kind of the alternative to the dominant left-wing cultural regime. If the GOP is actually successful long-term in moving the culture back to the center, if not the right, you know, they might lose some of these voters who see the GOP as the authoritarian side again, but they will also have won sort of in the more long-term issue. I mean, they won't, there's no final victories in politics, obviously, but I think if you look at the slate of anti-transgender laws, the slate of anti-critical race theory laws, the GOP becoming much more aggressive on issues like immigration and big tech, all of these issues that have cultural dimensions. I think what you're seeing is a Republican Party and a conservative movement that's actually capable of engaging in an aggressive enough way where they're actually interested in using public policy to move the culture back to, at the very least, the center in a way that you did not see during the sort of Paul Ryan era of Republican politics. And that's why I was pointing to figures like Ron DeSantis, Christopher Rufo, Tucker Carlson, all of these kind of new or resurgent conservative figures who are seen as thought leaders now for this new coalition. They want to actually fight the culture war aggressively. And I think that's what actually the majority of Americans want, at least on these issues. I think most Americans feel like the culture is increasingly hostile to the kind of way of life that they want to live and that their parents and their parents' parents lived. And that's, I think, has to be the organizing principle of the Republican Party when it comes to these issues, is standing up for those Americans and defending that way of life.
Yeah, really well said. The final or the most optimistic that I'll ever get is thinking, you know, when the left has gone scorched earth through all of our institutions, media, academia, so on and so forth, big business, when they have demolished the credibility of every institution and Americans are sort of rebuilding what they thought they knew about the world, I do think there's a chance that people discover, for instance, especially through new technology, what is so evil about abortion. I don't know if you've gotten that sense. I do sense that people are moving on that issue the more front and center it is in our politics, because the more you learn about it, the more, I guess, abhorrent the majority of laws that go, I would say, in blue states that allow this happen, you know, through the third trimester, Roe itself, are really unappealing. But that's just one issue. I think in general, though, we're kind of running an experiment. Like, we're not even 10 years into the experiment with gay marriage being legalized throughout the entire country. People's don't know who to trust right now. And as they're rebuilding some of this knowledge or rebuilding some of these ideas and opinions after 2020 and beyond, when people may have been favorable to things like, you know, we need systemic police reform, whatever, and are now seeing, you know, people who elected Chesa Boudin who are now recalling Chesa Boudin.
Right.
I think in the process of rebuilding some of the knowledge, it seems to me like in some places, people are actually rebuilding their knowledge in a more traditional way.
Right. And as you said, it's not just abortion. I mean, look at libs of TikTok, for example.
Right, exactly.
Why does the left and you know, people like Taylor Lorenz, why do they hate libs of TikTok so much? It's because libs of TikTok has been enormously effective in publicizing what's actually happening in our schools, particularly when it comes to sort of transgender ideology and progressive sexual and gender ideology in children, right? There are any number of examples, and I just anecdotally know so many young people, you know, in very left-wing areas like the college I went to, who have sort of been quietly radicalized by technology, because you're not obviously getting that narrative in the classroom or in the kind of dominant mainstream left-wing culture. But these digital tools, which the left not so long ago thought was going to favor them, have become an enormously powerful tool for kind of countering the narrative that they are trying to propagate. It's one of the reasons why you've seen this kind of hysteria about misinformation and disinformation on the internet in recent years, and why, you know, the Biden administration very briefly tried to actually create a government bureaucracy to police mis and disinformation, right? It's because all of a sudden people are talking to each other outside of the kind of credentialed established institutions and sharing information that the left doesn't want them to share. And that's enormously powerful because it is kind of showing people exactly what's actually happening. Like, you know, like Libs of TikTok has, for example. And that means that these cultural issues, not just abortion, but all the other issues that we're talking about, people are much more tuned into them, I think, and much more engaged. And you can't look away once you see what's actually happening. You can't tear your eyes away. And that, as I said, is why I think you've seen a right which is much more well-positioned in the culture war than it has been for decades, because people actually know what's going on and they don't believe the New York Times or the Washington Post or PolitiFact, you know, pick your sort of mainstream journalistic outlet when they tell them that it's not going on. People do not believe those institutions anymore. They've been discredited. And I think a large part of that has to do with these digital technologies that we're talking about.
Yeah, the Catholic Church, for instance, has seen a resurgence in Latin Mass. And you can, I think, read that dynamic into, read exactly what you were talking about just now, Nate, into that dynamic. And before I let you go, I just want to read some of your writing, because I think you put it really well here. This is the last part of your piece, which everyone should go read. It's up on the newyorktimes.com. The new cultural conservatism may protect the embattled minority of traditionalist Christians. It will not restore them to their preeminent place in public life, as the old religious conservatism hoped to do, but it may have an actual chance at winning. And that, from the conservative perspective, is worth a great deal. Nate, do you have any final thoughts on what you're describing there, which in a sense it is kind of weighing in, but weighing in more in the idea that this is at least worth something for the right? It is a victory in some sense. If even there have to be sacrifices made, and maybe this is my question for you, does the religious right really actually have to make any sacrifices other than maybe just prioritizing different things in order to make these political victories happen?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, prioritizing rather than necessarily making full concessions. But look, one of the core tenets of conservatism, both at a political and a philosophical level, is engaging with the world as it is rather than as we'd like it to be. Conservatives don't trade in political abstractions. We try to actually just look at the state of play and engage with the world in its broken, fallen form as much as we can. So one of the points of the piece was to try to be realistic about the state of play. Religiosity is declining in America, including among conservatives. Christianity is not as powerful of a political force as it was in the past. We have to make do, as traditional social conservatives at least, with the tools at our disposal. So there are serious problems, as I've said a couple times, with the fact that religiosity is declining. And I think particularly for religious conservatives, trying to engage with a conservatism which is not as amenable to kind of specifically or explicitly biblical or scriptural messaging is a loss. And we have to kind of reckon with that. But at the same time, as I was saying, there are also major political opportunities in the kind of new secular conservative coalition, which will be very good to religious conservatives and deliver on their priorities. And that is the kind of reality that we have to engage with. It's very imperfect. It might require trade-offs and concessions and being willing to be in a coalition with people that we might find distasteful, like someone like Dave Portnoy, who has views on abortion that I think are totally unacceptable. But if you can work with those people or find common cause on the issues where you see eye to eye, you're going to move the ball forward in a really substantive way. And that's a reason for at least cautious optimism, I think.
You know what we didn't even talk about is porn, which is it's such a good example of what you're saying, because I don't think the majority of Americans right now, maybe when Zoomers grow up and they're more engaged in voting, they will be able to reckon with how destructive that was for them. And I actually suspect that's probably the case. But right now, I don't think Republicans are going to win a ton of votes by waging an all-out war on porn. And there are some other issues. I don't know, like sexuality is a good one too, where you have that BuzzFeed piece on how Gen Z is rethinking sex positivity. There's a lot of stuff going on that isn't necessarily thought of to be political, but is really salient in the context of what you're talking about.
Right. And I would actually say on porn, it's a mixed bag. But one of the polls that I cited really quickly in the New York Times piece from the American Principles Project, which came out in May, poll tested in six battleground states, basically severely restricting porn for minors and doing a bunch of things to crack down on access to porn for children. And it polled at huge majorities across racial and even ideological lines. So, yes, if you are doing what I would like to do as a crazy social conservative and just basically ban porn outright, right? Just take Pornhub off the web, right? Like, that's a long-term goal. I don't necessarily know that you're going to get the Dave Portnoy's on board with that. But I think most people, again, most Americans are still very commonsensical. And if you say kids, especially young kids, should not be exposed to hardcore pornography, most people are going to nod their head. And I would like to see the left try to defend hardcore pornography for children. I don't think that's going to work out well for them. So
they will do it, though. They will.
Of course they will. Especially if the right starts talking about it, you know it's going to create this, you know, this inverse reaction where the left all of a sudden is all in on porn for kids. But I'd like to see them try. I think that would not work out well for them.
Let's hope so. And that's another question. It's just the general dynamic of where the public is. But I think you're right. The citing that APP poll is a really, I think, optimistic sign. And in general, my two cents is that bold colors, not pale pastels, that's a Reagan quote, are ways to actually attract voters. If you seem to really believe in your faith and in your country, that's really attractive to voters because it's authentic and sincere and you needn't sacrifice anything. But as Nate says, prioritizing things from, like, if you're sitting at the RNC, yeah, maybe they're going to prioritize different things, but hopefully they recognize that there's a real appetite, I think, for social conservatism, whether it's on porn or tech or whatever. That appetite really exists, and I think if you feed it, it'll grow stronger. So Nate Hochman, fellow at National Review, also a NOVAC fellow from TFAS, thank you so much for joining us again.
Hey, thanks, Emily. It was a pleasure.
Of course. Always love to catch up with Nate. You have been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.